For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. Last week's program ended with the premature death of Johann Strauss the Elder. It was a death provoked by the scarlet fever that the composer contracted from his stepdaughter Clementina. But it was also brought on by the extreme exhaustion caused by the hard work he put into the management, organization, and of course the execution of his concerts across Europe, before royalty and to the most enthusiastic audiences. Saddened on hearing the news, Hector Berlioz in Paris wrote, "Vienna without Strauss is like Austria without the Danube." With his death, the path lay open for his son, his namesake, to step into his shoes. But it was not to be an easy handover. The revolutions of 1848 had been quelled and the old systems of government reinstated. So the young Strauss's past revolutionary activities cast a shade on his career. Emperor Franz Josef was now at the helm of the Habsburg Empire. True that Metternich's harsh systems were a matter of the past, but any thought of a republic was now to be set aside while the army struggled to keep the empire together, quelling revolution in Hungary. If our young musician harbored any hope of success, he had to go along with the establishment. Also had to face a certain amount of opposition from his father's supporters, who went so far as to suggest that his ruthless pursuing of success may have sent his father prematurely to the grave. At this point, it was necessary for the young Strauss, now not even 25 years old, to make a diplomatic move. Spurred on by his teacher, Franz Amon, who had always supported and believed in him, he published a heartfelt apologia in the Wiener Zeitung. expressing his sincere sorrow at the loss of a father departed too soon and leaving a shattered family situation with a deserted mother and young siblings who needed support. I chose the art for which I felt a vocation. I only wished to earn the smallest part of the favor which my deserving father so richly reaped. Was his faith in the younger Strauss that Franz Amon was instrumental in convincing the musicians of the Franz Strauss Senior Orchestra to accept the young man as their leader. This they officially did on 7th October 1849 in the Kolonnadensaal of the Volksgarten, where for the first time the young Johann conducted them in a concert devoted entirely to the works of his famous father. Johann Jr. was now established as the conductor of the one and only Johann Strauss Orchestra. Like his father, he had stage presence, a magnetism that charmed his audience. He was tireless and hardworking. He was called to perform before Tsar Nicholas I during an autumn festival in Warsaw. He conducted the charity ball at the Hofburg Palace during Carnival 1851. But his revolutionary past still stood in the way to his being officially appointed as music director of the Imperial Court Balls. But he was clever and had mastered the art of flattery. In February 1853, when an assassination attempt was made on the emperor's life, Strauss composed his March of Rejoicing at the deliverance of Emperor Franz Joseph. Yet so much stress, so much work was telling on the king of the waltz's health. At the age of 27, Johann Strauss was seriously ill with a nervous breakdown, and the doctors ordered a prolonged rest at a sanatorium at Bad Gastein. This was tragic, for the whole family depended on him for conducting their rather privileged life in the comfortable, large Hirschenhaus. The family enterprise was under threat. Above all, the family music business could not be allowed to falter. Anna, the matriarch, had brought up her five children notwithstanding her husband's defection and early death. Her second son, Joseph, was a qualified mechanical engineer, whilst the youngest brother, Eduard, showed an aptitude for music and was an accomplished harpist. Anna and Franz turned to Josef, known as Beppi, within the family circle. Josef was a shy, gentle person. An engineer, he was happy to practice his profession, at which he was very successful, having resisted his father's insistence that he pursue a military career. Now that his elder brother lay ill and his mother pleaded with him, he was unable to turn a deaf ear to their appeal and to refuse to take over the baton. So, rather unwillingly, he accepted to conduct the orchestra. John Suscher writes, "It had all happened so quickly that Josef had no time to become even passably efficient on the violin, so that he had to conduct at the spurl with a baton, a severe break from the Strauss tradition. He took lessons in the violin and conducting, and even set about composing, so as to compose a new piece for each occasion, in true Strauss tradition." Josef's first composition he entitled The First and the Last. Yet, there was no turning back. In 2 decades, he was to compose more than 300 pieces and arrange at least 500 others. Johann was to declare, "Beppi is the more gifted of us two. I am merely the most popular." Beppi's musical life flourished, as did the family music business, which he had helped save. Johann returned to Vienna in September 1853, fully restored and ready to accept the invitation to conduct in Russia. In 1854, the director of the Tsarskoye Dzelo Railway Company led a delegation to visit Johann Strauss the Younger to entice him to accept to conduct the summer concerts at Pavlovsk in 1856. This meant traveling to St. Petersburg, the imperial capital of Russia, probably to perform before the Tsar himself and the Tsarina. In order to keep costs down, he was invited to go to Pavlovsk alone, without his orchestra, and to source his musicians in Russia. This worried him, as also did the fact that he had to leave his orchestra entirely in the hands of his brother, Beppi. At this point, we perceive the entrance of Edouard, the third brother, to the scene. By 1855, Edouard was playing the harp in the Johann Strauss Orchestra. He became known as Schöner Edi because of his good looks and elegance. What a great satisfaction for Anna to see her three sons, against all odds, achieving that which their father had always refused to accept. Often the brothers appeared together, entertaining enthusiastic audiences in the city's main music halls. Johann, who by now called himself Jean, felt that he could safely leave the orchestra in the hands of both his brothers, and he could embark on the Pavlovsk adventure. And some adventure it was to prove to be, for here in Pavlovsk, so our author recounts, Johann was about to fall head over heels in love. The opening concert in Pavlovsk was held on the 18th of May, 1856. Strauss included in the program music by his father and his own compositions, but also performed music by Verdi and Meyerbeer. It was a resounding success and the prelude to 10 years of successful Russian summers for Johann Strauss. The creme de la creme took the train from St. Petersburg to Pavlovsk to attend Johann Strauss's concerts, demanding so many repeats that the concerts ended so late at night that they had to find temporary night accommodation away from home. Strauss had to accept to give daily concerts throughout the summer season, from 2nd May to 2nd October. Needless to say, at the end of 1856 season, he was engaged for the following 2 years, receiving 18,000 rubles as well as free accommodation for the 5 months engagement each year. The Russian nobility simply doted on him, and there, during the Russian summers, Strauss composed some of his best-loved works, Pizzicato Polka, Champagne Polka, and cleverly dedicated to the coronation of Tsar Alexander II, the Kronungsmarsch and the Kronungslieder.
Let us go back a little early in history. The first constituted Russian state was the Grand Principality of Kiev, founded in the 9th century. It was followed by the paramount prominence of the Grand Duchy of Moscow. These lands had been evangelized by Greek Orthodox missionaries from the Byzantine Empire. The religious and cultural links between the two sides were strong. Grand Duke Ivan III married Helena, niece of the last Byzantine Emperor Constantine XI, who, in 1453, fell defending Constantinople against its Ottoman Turkish conquerors. Ivan III assumed the Christian Orthodox leadership in the East, proclaimed himself Tsar in 1462, adopted the imperial eagle as his emblem, and from then on, Moscow was considered as the Third Rome. By and by, Moscow, the capital of Russia, came to be considered as too conservative and backward, especially by a ruler of genius like Tsar Peter the Great. As a young child, a conspiracy of the boyars, or leading Muscovite nobles, against his trusted personal advisor, almost cost him his life. He never felt comfortable in Moscow, and in due course, Peter wanted to open up Russia to the Western world. modernize it, face the Swedish and Polish challenge in the west, and the Turks in the south. After a long reconnaissance trip to the west, mainly Germany, Holland and England, he also decided to open up a window to the west by building a new capital city on an extension of the Baltic Sea, namely the innermost area of the Gulf of Finland. The Baltic Sea, dominated then by Swedish naval and military power. Even before that power was broken by the 21-year-long Great Northern War, Peter had laid the foundation of the new city, christened it St. Petersburg after his patron saint. With the war over, Peter could indulge in his favorite pet project, building a powerful fleet and embellishing his new capital city. Whether they liked it or not, most of the boyars had to move from Moscow to the new capital city. They were even forced to shave their beards, wear wigs, and obliged to wear Western clothes. For the first time, too, members of the Romanov imperial dynasty started marrying into foreign, mainly German Protestant sovereign families. Little changed regarding daily life. Court intrigued move from the old to the new capital. Peter and later his successors, especially his niece Anna, and more so his daughter Elizaveta, and his granddaughter by marriage, Catherine the Great, created the beautiful city founded thanks to Peter's foresight. Architects, mainly from Italy, built beautiful churches, theatres, imperial palaces, palaces for the aristocracy, and grand mansions for the increasingly influential rich bourgeoisie of bankers, people in various professions, and the commercial class. Opera was dominated by the Italians, while the Russian school of ballet, which was to become so famous, was in part built on French foundations. The latter had in turn been founded upon Italian tradition. Literary life flourished, and many Russian composers looked west to the German tradition and established strong roots in St. Petersburg, while the cultural lingua franca was French. This was the St. Petersburg that Johann Strauss first visited in 1856 and where he was to return every year until 1865. The aristocracy, aped by the bourgeoisie, had the summer residences, and some even owned vast estates with thousands of landbound and landless serfs. This situation was to change after Tsar Alexander II emancipated the serfs in 1861, midway through the period when Strauss visited Russia. The rich could still afford to have their large retinues of servants to wait upon them, whether on their country estates or their urban residences. The incentive which led Strauss to visit Russia was the invitation of the Tsarskoye Selo Railway Company of St. Petersburg for him to play for a huge fee in Russia at the Vauxhall Pavilion at Pavlovsk. Tsarskoye Selo, now known as Pushkin, was where there was one of the main imperial residences, and the town of Pavlovsk developed in the vicinity. It attracted the rich and fashionable, but when it started getting out of fashion, the company thought of reviving its fortunes by a series of concerts conducted by Strauss. He was immensely popular, played for increasingly high fees, and enthused all. It happened, whether it was most ladies who found him very attractive, or whether because the Russians simply adored his music, so much so that when he performed his peasant's polka, which he considered as rather trashy, he noted with surprise that applause for it was superior to that accorded to some Beethoven and Mozart pieces he had conducted before it. Life for the rich and famous, whether aristocratic or bourgeois in Pavlovsk, reflected in miniature that of the capital city. They took their books, instruments, servants, and just carried on with life in a relaxing holiday atmosphere. Go promenading, pay social visits, and go to balls, and of course, for practically a decade, enjoy the presence of Johann Strauss. However, thanks to the railway connection, those not involved in court life around the imperial prisons could return to the capital, which is a mere 27 kilometers away. Not to mention that one summer evening, the audience was extremely enthusiastic, kept asking for encores, and they got them, and ignored the imminent departure of the last train to St. Petersburg, and waited out the night to catch the first train back next morning. Such was the magic of the Waltz King.
Dark and handsome, always immaculately turned out, Johann was very popular with the Russian ladies. Word went around that he had numerous affairs. And why not? He was single, unmarried. The satirical journal Trish Trash picked up the gossip, and he, tongue-in-cheek, composed the lively little polka by the same title, Trish Trash. John Susha tells us that one reviewer wrote, "Seemingly no dance composition of such freshness, humor, coloring, and spicy instrumentation has been published for years." During his third stay in Pavlovsk, Strauss was to fall in love. And this was no simple flirt. Strauss, at 33, fell in love with Olga Smirnitsky, the 21-year-old daughter of aristocratic parents. Romantic, sentimental, with a sense of humor and tantalizing moods. We shall learn what John Susha tells us about this love affair during the program next week. And here again, I thank Gerald Finnick, Albert Storace, the technicians at Campus FM, and I wish my listeners goodbye.